This week, we're dropping the needle with Tony Harnell of TNT fame. He's back with Ron Bumblefoot Thal and the Wildflowers, new EP. Dropping the needle.
You're listening to Dropping the Needle, the podcast where all music from all genres is discussed. New releases, classic albums, rediscovered music, signed and unsigned. No ass kissing. Just two guys talking about music. Here are your hosts, Michael Brandvold from Michael Brandvold Marketing and Mitch LaFon.
Hey everybody, welcome to another episode of Dropping the Needle, the podcast that's been described as if Beavis and Butthead ever had a podcast, this would be it. I am right. One of your co-hosts, Michael Brandvold from MichaelBrandvold.com, and as always, I'm joined by that world-renowned, world-famous rock journalist, Mitch LaFon. I think that hits the contract obligations for you, right?
No, you forgot illustrious.
Oh, damn it, illustrious. The illustrious how you doing? Rock journalist. Great. So let's just jump right into it. Why don't you introduce everybody to our special guest who's joining us today?
Yeah, listen, you know, he's working with somebody you know very well, Bumblefoot. We've got Tony Harnell, whose vocal range is unearthly. Oh, look, it's the phone.
It's your kids calling.
It actually is.
Feed us.
That's why the wife downstairs will answer it. Shall we re-intro or shall we
keep going. Moving? This is real. Yeah.
It's natural.
Yeah, so we got Tony with us, you know, a world-renowned singer. Illustrious singer.
Hey, guys. He deserves the title illustrious and world-renowned. Yeah. I'm not sure about you, Mitch.
Hey, listen. I got him here today, so I
there you go. There you go.
But Tony, pleasure to have you, you know.
Thank you.
I've been listening to your stuff, the TNT and the new stuff with Bumblefoot. I mean, you've been around for, what, 20, 25 years career-wise? And your voice is...
I was going to say, Mitch, it's, yeah.
30?
Yeah,
But look how young he looks.
I would say Knights of the New Thunder came out in 84 in Europe. So, yeah. And I started singing when I was 17. So I guess we're... getting close to 30 years now. Yeah.
So, you just said you started singing at 17.
I started singing at 5. But okay. But in okay. terms of like deciding to do it for a living, I was 17. Yeah.
What was the moment that clicked with you and said, you know what, I'm going to do this for a living?
Well, I'll try to tell it quickly. It was a funny story, actually. People love this story. I got out of high school when I was 16. I was living in San Diego, and I took the California High School Proficiency Exam, which is like a GED. And my grandparents gave me an ultimatum. I wanted to be a pro surfer because I had been a pro skateboarder.
Okay.
And they said, "Nah, that's not going to fly." And I wanted to move to Hawaii, and I had a sponsor interested in me, the whole nine yards. And they said, "Nope, you're either going to San Diego State University or you're moving to New York to live with your mom." My mom was already here because she was an opera singer singing with the New York City Opera. And I thought the idea of New York for somebody who was living on the beach was like the worst idea ever.
Yeah.
But for some reason I chose that direction. And I vowed to get back to California as soon as possible. Well, soon after arriving in New York, my mother introduced me to this guy who was a photography professor at a major college here in New York. And he looked at my portfolio because I was a photographer. And he got me a full scholarship at one of the big universities in New York. So I had a full scholarship. And during the first semester, I was driving my car around my neighborhood in Queens, New York. And I had the windows down a lot. It was summertime, and I had this 8-track tape player. Okay, I'm not giving away my age, but
fair enough. I had one too.
Yeah, and I was just singing along to all my favorite stuff, which was at the time like Priest and Scorpions, Priest, Zeppelin, and whatever I was into, UFO, whatever. And I had come to a stop sign one day, and these two guys that kind of like to me looked like hoodlums because I hadn't been in New York very long. Long hair, black clothes, leather jackets, you know, they're like, stop, don't drive, you know? And I'm like, oh my God, I'm going to get mugged right now. Like I'm dead. This is it. I'm like rolling the window up. I'm trying to lock the door and I'm trying to drive away. And they're like, no, it's okay. It's okay. It's okay. And they come over to my window and they say, are you the guy that's been driving through the neighborhood singing? And I'm like, what do you mean? What do you mean? Like, yeah, you know, driving, you know, we've been here. I'm like, you heard me? They're like, yeah, we've been trying to find you. so they stopped me.
To beat you up or to give you compliments?
No, they were long haired. They were musicians. And so they came over to my car and they said, well, we've been trying to track you down and now we found you and we have a band and we're rehearsing Saturday night and will you come and sing? We're looking for a singer.
Oh, that's crazy.
I was like, sing for a band? I'm like, okay. So, I showed up and I was in the rehearsal place, never sang on a microphone in my life, and ran through some Zeppelin. They told me to learn a few Zeppelin songs and a few other things. And that was it. It was like one rehearsal in that environment, and just the smells and the whole thing was just like, I'm done. This is it. And so I ended up joining that band. And then
what were they called? What was their name?
I don't even remember. Some stupid name, probably.
Yeah, Wicked Lester, I think.
Oh,
no.
What, no. No, that's not it.
Damn you.
And I ended up asking them if I could be in the band, and they were like, I don't know if you're ready or not. And then 2 months later, they were begging me to stay. And then I just kind of, by the end of that first semester in college, I went into see the guy, whoever he was, a counselor at the school, and I said, I'm done. Oh, he goes, well, why don't you just change your major to music? And I said, no, I'm just going to be a singer. So so that's how it began. And then I went through a succession of, I just put a game plan together in my head, and I went through probably 15 bands in 3 years. I handed my parents, though, when I quit college, I handed them a piece of paper that said all the things I was going to accomplish and when. There was a timeline. And I said, here's what I'm going to do. So they said, okay. And my mom couldn't really say anything because she was a singer. So I said, okay, all right. Well, I hope you know what you're doing. And fast forward to literally 3.5 years later, if that, and I'm sitting in the offices of what was at the time PolyGram, Mercury, now Universal, and I forgot about writing this piece of paper and everything. And one of the things on this piece of paper was that I would have a worldwide record deal with the biggest label in the world when I was 21, by the time I was 21. And I was 21, and I was sitting in the offices around this table with our lawyer and the entire band with TNT, and I was about to put the pen down to the contract, and I remembered the paper I gave to my parents.
Wow. That's really cool.
Now, there's power in writing things down, folks.
There is. Now, with your mom being an opera singer, did she give you lessons at all, or did you just sort of pick it up by her singing in the house?
She was probably singing when I was in the womb, you know? I think right. She was actually started, the peak of her career was around the time I was born. She was 19. And I just was, people are sort of, entertainment brats or whatever. Right. I was an opera brat. I was backstage at all her operas and hanging out with that whole world. So they even would put costumes on me and cart me out on stage and make me sing stuff for operas that needed kids. You know?
And I guess there was music going on in the house all day long.
Yes, and my mom was really into very eclectic taste, so she would be buying every new Beatles record that came out, and my aunt, who was a couple years younger, was getting all the hard rock stuff.
Nice.
So when I was like 8, 9, 10 years old, you know, my aunt was like listening to Zeppelin and turning me on to that, while my mom was listening to the Beatles and Elton John and all that stuff. So I was kind of getting that. And then my grandparents were sort of into really other stuff like Glen Campbell and country music and all sorts of other things. So I was collecting all these really amazing influences.
So what's the first album that you went and spent your money on?
Well, I was bought albums a lot, but so that's a different thing.
Yeah, it's a very different thing.
I had a Glen Campbell obsession when I was between about 5 to probably between 5 and 7 or 8 years old. I had every single album.
Really?
Yeah, I would sit and sing to them. Teachers would come over and I'd give little concerts singing to the records and stuff, you know. The first record I bought with my paper route money.
Yeah.
I think there were two I bought that day, and one of them was Goodbye Yellow Brick Road.
Elton John.
And I think the other one was Living in the Material World by George Harrison.
Oh, phew.
Pretty good, huh?
I thought it was a Madonna album. I was like, wait a minute. Yeah, no, those are very decent. I mean, wow, you're cutting your teeth on some great records. I mean, ask Mike what his first album was. Go ahead.
My first album, I can't remember. It was either the
Partridge Family,
the Love and Spoonful, or Brewer and Shipley.
Well, I did go through a Partridge Family phase, I must admit. So,
but you know, mine wasn't so much going through a phase. It was, I'm just a young kid, and you don't know anything about anything music-wise.
No.
And, you know, it's like you go into this record store and you're like, well, what am I going to buy? And you literally buy it because of the cover. And I think, like, the Love and Spoonful might have had this very colorful, cartoony cover. Great, I'm going to buy it. I have no fucking clue what these guys are like. You know, I remember going through that phase, and then I remember getting, like, an ABBA record.
Did you get the Bay City Rollers?
No, never got there. I did go through ABBA for a little bit. Then I finally honed in on Kiss and Cheap Trick. I think, you know, for most people, you kind of do that early on. It's like you've got to take those influences and kind of hone your own radar in on what you like.
Yeah, I mean, I think my path to getting into the metal thing and the hard rock thing was really organic and natural. You know, I remember in junior high, there was a jukebox in our cafeteria.
Right.
And I went to a real hip, you know, junior high school in Burbank, and it was in the mid 70s. So I remember just off the top of my head, there was like a constant sort of a few rotation of songs. I remember there was a lot of Aerosmith. What I remember was there's like about five or six songs I remember hearing a lot on that jukebox. One was Love Is Like Oxygen by Sweet.
Yep.
Yeah.
One was Penny Lane, for some bizarre reason, was being played a lot. I remember Dream On, of course, was being played a lot. And some Bowie. There was seems like there was a real mix of Brit pop and what was ever happening in a lot of Nugent. There was some Ted Nugent going on in there for sure. But I went through a Beach Boys phase. I went through an Eagles phase, and of course, those never left. I'm still into the Eagles and still into the Beach Boys, you know. So, and the Beatles. I mean, come on. And then of course when Queen hit. It was kind of, that was probably sort of where Queen and Aerosmith brought me kind of to get more interested in the harder stuff. And then a buddy of mine, he was a guitar player in junior high. I said to him, okay, you're listening to music that's like way, way heavier than anything I've ever heard. Like, give me two records to guide me in that direction. So he said, all right, listen to these and then you'll get it. He gave me Judas Priest, Stained Glass, and he gave me Rainbow Rising.
Wow.
So as a singer, you can imagine with kind of a mom who was an opera singer, that me hearing voices like that for the first time was like, wow, you know, this makes sense to me. It's rock, but it's got all the, it's so extreme that I was able to kind of like, so I latched onto it and I just started to sing in my car a lot. And that's how I developed, I guess, my voice.
Yeah, I mean, trying to emulate Rob Halford is something.
And Dio.
Dio.
Yep.
Yeah.
So that's kind of how that started. And
sure. A little Dio plug. The new Dio showed up yesterday.
I had a beautiful talk with Wendy on the Monsters of Rock cruise.
Yeah.
And she's amazing. She's really cool. I like her.
Yeah, Shirilla, so let's talk a little bit about the project with Bumblefoot. Now, you know, it says featuring Bumblefoot. Is it Tony Harnell and the Wildflowers, sort of this band, and then Bumblefoot's just joined along for this one album? Like, what's the whole project, concept, band?
We don't know.
We don't know, okay.
It could have easily been a Tony Harnell record.
Okay.
I sort of have the type of personality where if I can sort of form a band around me, it feels like, something that I think is a nice branding idea,
right.
But it's also, I tend to discover people sometimes living in New York, you know, so I discovered this amazing young violin player named Cassandra Sotos, who, as you've heard the record now, is absolutely a beautiful addition to the sound.
Agreed.
It creates an atmosphere that, and I think you'll agree that this record is not what you might think if you hear, oh, Tony put out an acoustic rock record, and you're thinking, it's just not that. It's actually its own kind of thing. So we were already off and running. We were already writing songs. And I ran into Ron out at NAMM in 2011, and we reconnected because we had met 20 years earlier. We were going to do a project together, and it just never manifested when we were both much younger. So we reconnected, and he was doing a little thing at his guitar booth, and he just all the fans were there, and he stopped in the middle of it, and he started to play and sing TNT songs once he saw me there.
I mean, he's a human jukebox, you know. You have to, for people who don't know Ron that well, or Bumblefoot, we had him on as a guest about 3 months ago, and he did the entire first Boston album, side A and side B, as a medley.
Yeah,
and it's like, Who does this?
We were throwing any tune we could think of out at him, and he was able to just start in on his acoustic guitar.
Yeah.
Amazing. I joke with him sometimes and say, you must have had a lot of time on your hands when you were a kid. You know, you must have been one of those kids that like was really like in his room practicing.
His basement,
like, all the time. Yeah. But so he ended up coming back to New York from touring with GNR, and he called me sometime in the summer of last year. And I said, well, let's get together. So he came and we had lunch and had a nice chat and started kind of working on a few little ideas just for fun. And then I had a show coming up within a week after that or something. And I said, why don't you come? And I said, learn one song. And I gave him a song to learn, and he learned it. He came to the show, got up and played the song, and then just mostly just watched us and watched what we were doing. And the next day he called me and he said, dude, that was the best acoustic show I've ever seen in my life. And I said, well, my guitar player, who is great, doesn't really want to tour. He doesn't want to do shows outside of New York. So I said, do you want to be a part of this? We're in the middle of making an EP, and I'd love you to be a part of it. He said, yeah. He just went, yeah. So I said, well, I don't know how this is going to work. And we talked it over about his schedule and everything, you know, and all the details there. So after sort of talking it through, and then he did his first full show with me on for my birthday show that we did a few months after that, and it just started to build, and then we were making, you know, writing the songs and started recording and so forth. And so the reason for the name came about because I knew his schedule was going to be crazy, so I didn't want to have the project be beholden to his schedule. I wanted to be able to go out and promote the record. Right. With or without him. So I came up with this band name and said, what if I call it this and then just put featuring, you know, Bumblefoot on the bottom. So if you're there, awesome. And if you're not there, I can still go do shows. And any group of people could be the Wildflowers, you know. And so that's what we decided to do. And then the reason that the other guitarist is not on the front cover is because he didn't want to tour. So it just became this big branding thing that I did, and I put him on the inside of the CD.
So is it safe to say that Bumblefoot really, as much as his schedule permits, he's a member of this band?
I think so. I mean, you know, he's got, as you guys probably know from interviewing him, he's got his hands in a lot of different things right now. Yeah. And I think it's, I actually introduced him to somebody in California that he's been working with that I think completely turned his world upside down. And now he's really got his hands full. So,
who's that? Can we ask, or is that top secret?
It's not secret. It's not important. But anyway, so it's all good. It's a really cool person. But so I think that things are taking off for him in all aspects of his career. So we're about to shoot this video with a huge production company in New York, and it's going to be a really big deal for us because it's an opportunity that really the only people that would get to shoot with this video company would be major bands signed to major labels.
Right.
So, like, for example, they did the award-winning video for Muse for the song Uprising and on and on, Wolf Mother, and, you know, they're big time. They do a lot of TV commercials and short films and independent films and so forth. So they're probably the biggest in New York production company there is. And I happen to know the president of the company. He's a huge fan of mine. He wants to really see this record do something. So this is sort of a whole just beautiful thing that's happening, and I'm getting this opportunity to. So I just saw the treatment today, by the way, for the first track. And ironically, the track that's been chosen is Burning Daylight, which is the only song that Ron and I wrote together for the album, for this EP, a 9-song EP. It's not really an EP. It's not really an album. It's sort of a, it's an EP, it's an EP album. I don't know.
It's an ELP.
The album. Yeah, there you go. ELP. So that's going to, I think, make a big impact, because not only are they shooting the video, it's the treatment I saw just blew my doors off. I just saw it literally right before this interview, and it's phenomenal. The whole thing is amazing, and they're going to also be placing it in very prominent places.
Nice.
So I have a feeling that it's going to be, it's just one of those opportunities. I think it's going to be really, really cool. And I think that once that video comes out, who knows what his commitment will be at that point. But I'm happy to have him. He played all over the record, even though he didn't write all the songs. And he added so much
flavor,
beautiful color. And, you know, everything he played was very appropriate to the song, you know. And every song, I think, as you guys know by listening to it, is they're all kind of different from each other.
Yeah.
It's kind of a very eclectic record.
Yeah.
But yet there's a tie-in. It's kind of a thread, you know. And he just, you know, threw some great little licks here and there, very tasty, as you know. And of course, the Somebody to Love thing was phenomenal, because all those background vocals are him. I join in and do the stuff at the end, but all the great stuff into the verses is just all him, you know.
So, Tony, you did something interesting with this. You did a Pledge Music campaign.
That's exactly what I wanted to ask him
about. You know, fairly new for, well, it's definitely new in the industry, but a lot of fans don't even quite understand this whole concept yet. You know, what led you to do this crowdfunding where the fans pledge money and pay up front for you to record the product? How did that come about?
So it's a freedom thing. You know, it's kind of like, if you think about where I come from and what the labels would want from me, mostly what they want from me is 80s music recycling what I did before.
Right.
So it ends up being like, you know, the only way that I can get a deal is to recycle what I did before. So,
that's got to be frustrating.
Well, it's frustrating because I wanted to do something different. So, and as you can hear from this record, it's definitely putting me in a different light, which is what I wanted to do. So the fans have been amazing, and they really stepped up, and we met our goal relatively quickly, and we were able to donate quite a lot of money to my charity as well, which was really cool. So it really just kind of win-win all the way across the board. We could have recorded it with no budget, but it really helped a lot to have one. So
did you encounter any pushback from fans or media going, oh my God, you know, here's Tony, he was in TNT, he had major label deals. What does he need to ask fans for money up front for? That's not right, you know?
No, I didn't get any of that. And I think that that's what I like about Pledge versus Kickstarter, is a Kickstarter puts out there how much money you're trying to get, whereas Pledge just has a percentage of what your goal is. And so I think that's a classier approach, because, you know, I could have been asking for very little or nobody would know. And the difference also is that you get 60 days to meet your goal rather than 30. So you get more time with Pledge. And you get a charity. So I think that, you know, everything about it was really cool. And I think most people stepped up. And you know what? If they had any concerns about it, they didn't pledge.
Now, let me ask
and they probably figured they'd wait, you know.
Yeah, the follow-up to this, though, you know, the campaign was successful. Mm-hmm. Do you go back to Pledge for the next album? Or do you think, okay, now a label's going to take me more seriously, or whatever the word is, and do you want a label to back you up on the next album, or were you happy with this and do it again?
Typically, talking to Pledge, they say that the second record that people do with them usually does way better than the first in terms of how much you earn.
But what about you as an artist? I mean, do you want
to do that? Well, let's see what happens with the video.
Okay.
That's going to be the barometer, because like I said, nobody in my position gets a shot at doing a video of this level.
Right.
It's not done. So I'm getting this huge opportunity to do a very high-end, beautiful-looking, you know, world-class, major label-looking video. So let's see what happens from that. And the if that turns into something where they want to alter the record and re-release it and do something with it, or re-release this and then go into another record, you know, who knows what's going to happen. So I'm just kind of keeping everything open until the video hits and we get out and do some more shows and stuff and see kind of where it develops. But I would totally do a pledge campaign again in a heartbeat. I know what to do. I learned a lot from doing it. And the hardest part is fulfilling all the stuff when you're finished, because there's a lot to do. And, right.
And you're doing it alone. You don't have a team.
I'm doing it alone.
It's you, Ron, and you know.
Ron's very busy. So I'm doing most of it myself, with my wife, and, you know, it's quite a process. So we're getting there, but I think what's cool is that, Pledge has been really great. And they say, yeah, most people take a few months to get everything sort of done and get out. So, no, I'd totally do it again. I think it was a very successful campaign, more so than they thought. We did way better than Pledge thought we'd do.
Yeah. Now, the other thing you mentioned a couple of times was branding. Mm. It's not very often that you hear an artist talk about branding or be aware of branding.
Outside of Gene Simmons.
Right. Well, but that's basically it. I mean, outside of Gene, most of the rock guys are like, give me a couple of beers, you know, give me my guitar, I'll sing a song, and that'll be my evening. What does it mean for you to branding? How do you want to establish your brand? What's the game plan there?
I am completely proud of my past, and I totally appreciate the fact that a lot of my fans maybe only want to hear me do stuff that's similar to TNT or European style, you know, high pitched metal screaming or whatever, and that's awesome. But that's not what really I'm all about as a complete picture. And I think this record shows that. Okay. And I think that that's really been my goal. I started singing other kinds of music. It's kind of one of the things where I just so happened to make a name for myself doing the TNT thing. So I guess it's sort of been, all I'm really looking to do is just reach more people and not be labeled, because I'm really into so many kinds of music that I just think that if people see me as just a rock singer, that would be pretty much what I'm looking for.
Does that mean you step away from being a rock singer for a while? I mean, do you take 2 or 3 years away from doing the rock thing to establish another voice? Or
I mean, that's what this is kind of an acoustic rock record. Right. And it's got a lot of colors and flavors in it that I think cover a lot of bases vocally. So I think I'm really happy with this, and I'd be happy to going back and doing a really hard rock record. But I definitely don't really want to do necessarily a traditional 80s sound, because I feel like it's not that those influences wouldn't naturally maybe be there a little bit, but I don't think that it's kind of like I've been there, done that. So as much as I know the fans want to hear it and I want to do what they want, I think there's a way for me to combine everything. Okay. So if they want to hear me sing that way, I can definitely throw some notes in there, because that's what I do anyway, because I have those notes. But I don't necessarily want to write those kinds of songs. And I think that I've just moved on as a writer and as an artist. And so I guess what I'm trying to do is find a way of not alienating my longtime fans who I adore, who have made everything basically possible for me, but at the same time sort of trying to pull them with me wherever it is I'm going.
Yeah. And that's a tough challenge for any artist.
Absolutely. Right? Yeah. And I'm aware of that. And I think that what I'm doing is definitely going against the grain, but I just can't live with myself being a nostalgia kind of, you know, kind of artist.
Legacy artist is what they call them, right?
And, you know, if TNT was a really big band, that would have been a great option, you know, in terms of just making a living. But it kind of wasn't really big enough to go out and make a living doing, even with TNT, outside of, say, a few territories.
Yeah, let me ask you about TNT. They seem to have done much better in Europe than in the States.
Mm. It seems that way, but it's actually not really true, because if you look at the sales history, and if I look at my graph, for example, on my Facebook fan page, the majority of the fans are in the U.S. So,
but you spent more time touring in Europe, basically.
We did, but the majority of our record sales were here and in Japan.
That's interesting.
We were number one in Norway for weeks and weeks and weeks. And we had, you know, huge, huge, huge band. I mean, probably the biggest hard rock band ever come out of Norway, outside of maybe Turbo Negro or something.
Right.
But Norway is a small country. So if you sell 100,000 records in Norway, you're,
it's like
you're
double like platinum.
Huge. Yeah. But here we did, you know, a couple records in a row. I think we sold probably 500,000 to close to maybe even close to 1 million records over time in the States, and the rest of it was overseas. So it was probably 2 million in the bulk of the main years, the good years, you know. Yeah, so I would say there's probably more fans in the U.S., but concentrated-wise, there are definitely a lot of them everywhere else. Yeah.
Well, Tony, I mean, what are your thoughts on the current TNT that's out there?
I don't have any. I was with them on the cruise. I hung out with them. If I wasn't with my buddies in Striper or my new cool friend Todd from Queensryche, or you know whoever I knew so many people. It's like a high school reunion. But I was with TNT, you know, I was hanging out in Ronnie's room like half the time. So they're like brothers, you know, but, I haven't really heard their music, you know, I've heard like little pieces of some of the music, but it's kind of like, it's similar to the idea of, I'm glad that my ex-wife is with somebody else, but I don't necessarily want to walk in on it.
Right.
On her having sex or something. You know, it's kind of like that with them. It's like, it's great that they're, you know, moving forward, but I don't necessarily want to, you know, listen to it. Sorry, I keep looking at my clock because I'm just a little bit short of time.
So there's no bad blood. There's no animosity.
In the beginning, it was a little weird. There was a lot of press and bad stuff going on over in Scandinavia, but luckily it didn't really reach over here. And we've talked it all through, and it was mainly just that they were upset that I left. And there's a lot of reasons why, and I really would rather not get into it. And
right.
I'll be working on, I know everybody says they're working on a book, but it will be in the book.
Yeah,
I'm not into doing shit throwing books though. You know, for me, it's more just about maybe explaining a few things and moving on.
Now, I know, Tony, you had said that you only had about 20 minutes today, and we're up to 36.
Yeah, I talked a lot, sorry.
No, we love it. Hey, we'll do an hour with you. But, Mike, do you want to get in one last question?
Yeah, maybe part two.
We can
do part two.
Yeah. You know, Tony, just kind
part
of
part two of the performance.
Yeah, there you go. Last question for me would be, you know, you've mentioned the desire to go out and do some shows with the new band. What is the plan? What do you hope? You know, you talked about the video. What are you hoping to do for the rest of 2013 with the band?
Well, my goal is to establish an acoustic sound, an acoustic situation that I can always come back to. So if I'm not doing a hard rock thing, I'm doing an acoustic thing, and then juggle the two. So it would literally be, I guess, you know, on some scale smaller than something like what Chris Cornell is doing, where he's sort of banging down Garden and going out and doing his acoustic sets. And I think that's what this record is for. If I can establish this as one of the things I do that I can jump back to all the time, then I can ultimately, I'd love to form kind of, you know, get together with really big famous guys that are much more famous than me and be the least famous person in sort of a super group.
Yeah.
And then do a really great hard rock project. And there have been a few people contacting me about that kind of stuff. So it's just a matter of finding the right fit.
Yeah. And you know, the last question for me is, you know, you're a great vocalist, and I'm sure somewhere along the line you must have been invited to join bands that were losing vocalists, you know, Warrant or... But you resisted. You've always resisted going and joining those bands. Why didn't you go be the new vocalist in Great White or in Poison or in, like, you know?
I wasn't offered as many as you would think because I live in New York, so I'm sort of off the beaten path, and that's why when I went to NAMM 2 years in a row, everybody was like, you know,
should have thought of him.
We would have thought if we had remembered, you know. So it was one of those things. But I probably wouldn't. It would take a very special band for me to say yes to, and it would most likely be, you know, I don't know. I don't want to say I love all the guys in all those bands. So it just would depend. It would really depend on the songs and whether I could really find a way to make myself work into it and be happy with it. No, I turned down a lot of stuff, and it hurts my bank account. But I've always kind of been about integrity over that for better or for worse.
For better or for worse, yeah. Well, it's respectable. What do we need to plug? I mean, obviously,
there's
the Pledge
Music campaign. Where can people find you online?
right now, it's all CD Baby is where it is. It's going to pop up on iTunes very soon. You know how the thing works. It takes about a week or so for iTunes to kick in, and then the hard copy of the CD, which is a beautiful package, there'll be a link for that posted very, very shortly as well. So they'll be able to get all that through CD Baby, until which time we're pretty confident once the video hits that we're going to have distribution from somebody. And at that point it'll be out of my hands and hopefully into a better promotional situation, and we'll just see what happens. You know, anything is possible. I'm a very optimistic guy, so I keep a realistic view, but I'm very optimistic. I'm a glass half full guy. Exactly. So I have high expectations for this, and I think it's going to do well, and I think it's going to surprise a lot of people once it starts to get heard.
What's your website?
TonyHarnell.com. It's still being done, it's still being worked on. So I try to direct people to the Reverb Nation site, which is right. Just Reverb Nation Tony Harnell, and from there they can hear a couple samples of the new thing. And if you join my mailing list, you get to actually hear them, and then hopefully that entices you to go buy. And the links are actually attached to those songs to go find the album.
Right. And are you doing the Twitter, Facebook thing as well?
Like crazy right now. Yeah. I'm really gotten grooved into tweeting lately. I've gotten some help with that, and it's quite a world. So getting more away from the from kind of the Facebook thing and more into where it really matters, you know.
Right.
Yeah.
But it's got to be interesting though as an artist to be able to have that connection with the fans, because years ago you sat in a studio, you made an album, you gave it to the record company. By the time you got to the fans, it was a year later, and then you'd only see them backstage, maybe, you know, so.
Yeah, it's true. I mean, it's good and bad. I mean, mostly it's good. There's always a couple, you know, a couple people that are, you know, that sort of
persistent.
Take things too far.
We'll call them persistent.
Yeah, but I'd say like 99.9% of the fans are beautiful and amazing. They respect your privacy and they're awesome. So I think the connection part of it is really, really great.
Yeah. Well, thank you for your time. I know you got to get going, so thanks a lot.
Thanks so much, Tony.
Thank you, guys.
That was very cool, Mitch. You know, yeah. I remember playing TNT 10,000 Lovers quite a bit back in the late 80s on college radio at my metal show. So it's kind of cool catching up with Tony and finding out what he's doing. And obviously, we both got connections to Bumblefoot, so we both were aware of the project, but it was kind of nice getting this update straight from the horse's mouth.
Yeah, and it was interesting to see what the concept of the band is. I mean, it's sort of going to have some people float in and out, and it's going to, you know, get him out there doing the acoustic shows, and of course, you know, keeping his voice ready so when the next big rock gig comes along, he'll be good to go. You know, and he's going to do a song for me on that Kiss tribute, so...
What song?
What did he say? Love Gun. Ain't that gonna be awesome?
Yep.
That's gonna be a voice for that. So, you know, it was fun catching up with him, and he was very, very pleasant. I didn't know what to expect. I mean, I've never interviewed him in terms of a formal interview before, so I didn't know if he was gonna be one of these guys who give you those yes/no answers and you're left scratching your head. But no, he gave us great stories. I love the story about, you know, his driving around in the car.
Yeah, that two guys in long hair and leather jackets. Like, were you the guy that's singing? We've been looking for you.
Yeah, because that sounds like trouble in any other neighborhood, if you
ask me.
Exactly. So I never knew his mom was an opera singer. I'm sure it's been in the press before, but I've just missed that.
Your final question about him, you know, potentially playing with other artists. Had you ever heard rumors of him being considered or auditioning for anyone?
I actually had not heard rumors, but I mean, I know that a lot of the guys like Robert Mason and Jizzy Pearl and all these guys who sort of float from band to band end up getting called by everybody who loses a singer. So I had to assume that he must have been in the same boat because he's got a great voice.
Yeah.
I mean, who wouldn't want them fronting his band? I mean, you look at Great White when they made a change. You look at Rat when they threw Piercy out. You look at, you know, Janie Lane when he passed away. Who wouldn't want Tony to step in there? He can bring those songs and any song to the next level. So I assumed. And, you know, listen, obviously he had been called by some people.
Just didn't name them.
He didn't name them. You know, I'm curious though, because
put on your investigative hat and start asking the bands who they've auditioned.
Yeah, you know, that's what I'm going to have to do.
Because if his name pops up.
No, but look at Judas Priest and Iron Maiden when they lost their singers in the 90s. Judas Priest in particular needs a voice that's powerful and can hit those octaves. Tony would have been ideal.
Yeah.
So who knows? And he's a fan, so, you know. But anyway, it was good to hear from him. So, you know, get out there.
I wonder if he could replace Paul Stanley.
You know who could replace Paul Stanley, believe it or not, is Ron Bumblefoot Thal. The Detroit Rock City that he did for me on that Kiss tribute, I've played it at home, and my kids keep saying, that's a new version. I haven't heard Paul do that before. And I'm like, it's not Paul. They go, yes, it is. So it's interesting. I'll have to sneak peek that.
He'd have to shave his beard, and I don't think he'd want to do that.
Oh, you can just put the makeup like right to here and just leave the beard out. No? That could be a new look. It's okay, though. Anyway, so there you go.
Not going to happen. All right, guys. So thanks once again for tuning in. Leave us your comments. Let us know what you think. Head over to droppingtheneedle.com, facebook.com/droppingtheneedle. Let us know. Yeah. Thanks, everyone.
Cheerio.
Hello, this is Bumblefoot from Guns N' Roses, and I just released my own award-winning gourmet hot sauces, from the mild cherry bourbon Bumblicious to the over-the-top Bumblefucked. So, if you want to get Bumblefucked, visit bumblefoot.com for more information.
You've been listening to Dropping the Needle.
Dropping the Needle.
With Michael Brandvold and Mitch LaFon.